The topic for this evening is happiness, and I know that might seem kind of, what, a little bit weird or what, too common? I don't know. But in fact, I think there's a lot of really interesting things to say about it. Starting off with this question, we say we want to be happy, but what does that really mean? What is happiness? We have this word, happiness, and so we presume it must correspond to something, but what is that? I mean, we know that there's overlap with joy, pleasure, contentedness, and so forth, but there's still a kind of essential vagueness there. It's interesting, Dante wrote, his great Divine Comedy in the Middle Ages, and it was divided into three parts because supposedly he visited hell and then purgatory and then heaven, and he wrote about them. And he had no trouble talking about hell, right? The inferno. We could all relate to the horrible sufferings, tortures going on there. A little more tricky talking about purgatory, but actually, when he got to paradise, the third, the final, it's much harder. It's kind of vague. How do you depict something like that? It's interesting that today, as opposed to a century ago, there's a lot more interest, I think, a lot more sort of even scholarly discussion of happiness and what makes people happy. 100 years ago, Freud, he was preoccupied with what you might call abnormal psychology or the psychology of, again, how we're unhappy. And he himself said that his concern was to replace neurotic unhappiness with daily, regular, normal unhappiness. But I think it's interesting that there's so much more, including in the Buddhist tradition. So, as some of you may know, there's a the Tibetan Buddhist figure, Matthieu Ricard. He's written a book on happiness. And it's quite a good one, although I won't be talking about it this evening. What does Buddhism have to say about happiness? Well, maybe there's a bit of the same problem. The answer isn't so obvious, and it kind of goes along with Dante in the sense that arguably the single most important term in Buddhism isn't anything to do directly with happiness. It's dukkha, right? That's the word that is usually translated into English as suffering. Although we have to understand it, as I say, in the broad sense, dissatisfaction, frustration, anxiety, dis-ease. And the Buddha himself, he was very clear that this is the most important thing he has to offer. He said all he had to teach was dukkha and how to end it. The Four Noble Truths, right? They're all about dukkha, right? The cause of dukkha, the end of dukkha, how to end dukkha. I think most of us are quite familiar, maybe, with the term dukkha. What many of us don't know is that there's actually a pretty important term for happiness as well. Sukha rhymes with dukkha, but not emphasized nearly as much. It's the word, it's often translated as happiness, but also ease, joy, bliss. And it's interesting that the main contrast, if you look at where the word sukha is used, it's not so much contrasted with dukkha, but with the word praya, which refers to sort of more transient pleasures, right? So the point about sukha is that it's not just a momentary pleasure or moment of joy, but it's really something long-lasting. And of course, the idea of Buddhist practice, although we tend to talk about it in terms of awakening, enlightenment, something we realize, you could say that the goal of Buddhist practice is sukha, is to become happy. Some of you may be familiar with the term sukhavati, a very important term in East Asian Buddhism, in Pure Land Buddhism. Sukhavati It's the realm or the home of Amida or Amitabha Buddha. And in Pure Land Buddhism, which is by far the most popular type of Buddhism in East Asia, the idea is that if you have faith in Amida Buddha, then after you die, he can take you to his Pure Land. And it's such a great place to be that it's easy to practice and it's easy to attain nirvana from there. So there's this interesting question then, is Sukhavati, is it really another realm, another world, another place? I mean, there was one important Japanese Pure Land teacher, Shinran, you know, who said, no, it's just, it's right here, that, you know, that our goal and practice shouldn't be to gain what we already have, but rather to express our appreciation to Amida Buddha for what this world really is. It's about realizing something about this world, that it is in fact a world of bliss or a world of joy, a world of happiness, if we can realize something. So that too raises the question, is sukha simply a matter of removing suffering, removing you know, delusions, removing all the things, and it's just a natural, that's just the way things are when we get rid of the dukkha? Or is that maybe the emphasis on that would simply be contentedness or serenity? And in fact, what we normally think of as happiness, maybe it needs to be something more? There are a couple places in the Pali Canon, the earliest teachings we have, where the Buddha does talk about sukha. For example, in the Ananda Sutta, he describes four types of happiness for a householder. Householder being someone who, not a monastic, but people who have families and jobs and so forth. So he describes the four types of happiness. Number one, earning wealth justly. Number two, using, sharing that wealth with family and friends and monastics, right? Giving things to them. The happiness of debtlessness, not being in debt. And fourth, the happiness of blamelessness, that is to say, being able to live a pure and faultless life without committing evil. What I want to focus on this evening, though, is not what the Buddha said or what Matthieu Ricard wrote, but in fact, I want to read and comment on a recent article in The Atlantic magazine by Arthur C. Brooks. And if you read The Atlantic, you know that he's been doing this really interesting thing. He's been writing this series of articles in The Atlantic about happiness, how to become happy. And one of the most recent ones I read, which really impressed me, a particular article where he summed up, in fact, he titled, A Happiness Columnist's Three Biggest Happiness Rules. Beginning, and he begins with the leader, a good life isn't just about getting the details right. Here are some truths that transcend circumstance and time. Truths that I think are very relevant to Buddhism and Buddhists. In fact, they all seem very Buddhist to me. And maybe I should mention, if you like, I can share the URL, you know, the internet link for that at the end, if anyone wants to try to look up the original article. Anyway, three rules, essentials, maxims, right? Number one, Mother Nature doesn't care if you are happy. Brooks says, perhaps the greatest error people make about happiness is assuming it will come naturally if we follow our instincts. If it feels good, do it. Well, I was raised in the 60s. I've heard that. There's a simplistic sort of logic here, he says. Humans desire lots of worldly rewards, like money, power, pleasure, and admiration. We also want to be happy. So if we get that worldly stuff, we'll be happy, right? Well, no. As he says, this is nature's cruelest hoax, perpetuated to make sure that we pass on our genes with no consideration of whether we enjoy doing so. Wow, important point, right? Yes, we're products of evolution, and evolution doesn't really care if we're happy or not. The point is reproduction, which is why, for example, sexuality is so incredibly pleasurable, for most people, the most pleasurable of all. Anyway, Brooks goes on, your brain's reward system keeps you chasing earthly delights that will enhance your reproductive fitness in comparison with others. These fall broadly into the categories of money, power, pleasure, and honor, which the medieval theologian Thomas Aquinas called substitutes for God. Whether you buy Aquinas' assessment or not, you can't really argue with him that these rewards overpromise and under-deliver happiness. They simply don't satisfy. Or we can say, they don't satisfy for very long. And I think, again, he's onto something really right and important. But of course, for Buddhism, nothing new there, right? Given that the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths, that most common summary, right? The Buddha zones in, right, on craving or desire, that's what keeps us unhappy, chasing after trying to satisfy those desires, right? Think of the first and second noble truths. Yeah, life is dukkha, and the cause of dukkha is craving. But I would like to read to you a couple paragraphs from a more contemporary statement. In fact, the best contemporary version that I know, which is from a commencement talk at a college, presented by the novelist David Foster Wallace. Right. This is what he says, or part of what he says. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. No such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Godness or the Four Noble Truths, or some ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally bury you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, epigrams, the skeleton of every great story. The trick is to keep this truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you'll need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. He goes on. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they are unconscious. Default settings. The kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world won't discourage you from operating on these default settings, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fear, on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. Well, for some of us anyway. The freedom to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms alone at the center of all creation. This kind of freedom has a lot to recommend it. But of course, there are all different types of freedom, all different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious You won't hear much talked about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The really important type of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able to truly care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. This is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. I love to read that. He says it so well. I've also tried to write about this issue, certainly much less eloquently, when I talk about things like lack projects, right? And the way I express it, tried to express it, because as Buddhism says, right, there's no real separate self. We have the sense of separate self, but it's a delusion. But in contemporary language, right, our sense of self is a construct, right? It's a psychological and social construct. It's the way that mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting and reacting and remembering and it's the way all of those tend to work together. And because there's no real self, because the sense of separate self is a construct, what it means, it really doesn't have any reality of its own. It doesn't actually exist. And I think the way that that comes out, the way that we normally experience it, is as a sense of lack, as a sense that something is missing, not quite right, that there's something wrong with our lives. And if you think about it, this fits really well with what I just read by David Foster Wallace, right? Kind of the motivation behind how we fall into these kinds of default settings, because you can say we're looking for a way, we're misunderstanding what the problem is, and we're looking for something outside that might fill up our sense of lack, whether it's money or fame or power or sexual conquest or being beautiful or whatever. And of course, the way that Buddhism really addresses this, that it can help us see through this delusion of a separate self, help us let go of these, what I call lack projects, where we try to fill in this sense of this bottomless pit. And of course, sadly, it doesn't work, because the usual ways we try to fill up the sense of lack, I mean, they're symptoms of the more fundamental problem, and they're always sort of, we're projecting into the future. We're planning for some time in the future when we'll have everything we think we need, and then we'll be okay, right? Which means that we tend to be always future-oriented, what we're going to become, what we're going to have. But since the future never arrives, so seeking happiness there is futile. And this, of course, gives me an opportunity, if you've ever heard a talk by me, you've heard me say this, but I'm going to say it again, this quotation from Nisargadatta, right? When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life flows, right? Wisdom and love, right? He wasn't a Buddhist, but very Buddhist concepts, right? The two pillars of the Buddhist path. Huh? Real, you know, in the practice, we become able to let go of ourselves and realize our non-duality. And because the lack projects, because the sense of lack is, as it were, the shadow, the other side of this delusive sense of separate self, by having this experience, we can let go of the lack projects. One way to summarize it, it is said that nobody can be happy all the time, so be nobody. Can we say, in a way, that's one way of understanding what the Buddhist path is helping us do? Anyway, Arthur Brooks continues, "Happiness is your responsibility, not Mother Nature's. That means you need to curtail your worldly appetites and instead pursue what truly brings enduring happiness." And he mentions four things. One, a faith or life philosophy, family relationships, real friendship, and meaningful work. And wow, because again, fascinating parallels in Buddhism, or not even parallels, the same thing, right? A faith or life philosophy, well, what about the middle way, the Eightfold Path, huh? Family relationships, well, think about Sangha, community. And Brooks mentions real friendship, reminding us of that wonderful exchange in the Pali Canon where Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, you know, says to him, "Venerable sir, this is, it seems to me, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." And the Buddha replied, "Not so, Ananda, not so. That is the entire holy life, Ananda. Good friendship, good companionship, comradeship. When a monastic has a good friend, a good companion, comrade, it's to be expected he or she will develop and cultivate the noble Eightfold Path," right? I mean, how important it is to have spiritual friends, that we help each other along the way. And of course, the fourth thing that Brooks mentioned, which he's mentioned as truly bringing enduring happiness, is, right, meaningful work. And frankly, I cannot conceive of more meaningful work than the Bodhisattva path. So that's the first maxim, right? Happiness is not something nature is going to give us, it's our responsibility. And that leads to maxim number two. Lasting happiness comes from habits, not hacks. And Brooks says, "We live in a culture of hacking or finding shortcuts to achieve otherwise time-consuming goals. The internet is full of happiness hacks that will supposedly boost your well-being in surprising ways, but with little effort. And indeed, you can use small, easy actions to change your emotional state quickly, such as turning off the notifications on your cell phone, which I recommend. But for enduring happiness changes, you need habits, not hacks. And by habits, I don't mean mindless routines. I mean mindful daily practices to strengthen your relationships, deepen your wisdom, and uncover meaning in your life." Mindful daily, well, Buddhist practitioners know something about that, right? Brooks continues, "Happiness hacking tends to trivialize happiness as little more than a feeling, but this is an error. Happy feelings are evidence of happiness, which is a combination of enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose." I guess we can say, maybe we have to understand happiness as a side product. He quotes psychologist Abraham Maslow, quote, "Happiness is an epiphenomenon, a byproduct, something not to be sought directly, but an indirect reward for virtue. The only happy people I know are the ones who are working well at something they consider important." A couple days ago, I saw on Facebook, there's an Australian comedian, Tim Minchin, and one of the things he said, "Happiness is like having an orgasm. If you think too much about it or try too hard, it goes away." Right? So again, happiness as a byproduct. And again, I'm reminded here too of, you know, the great Spinoza, Benedict Spinoza, the philosopher. I think it may even be the very last proposition in his greatest work, The Ethics, where he says, you know, the Latin word is beatitude, can be translated various ways. Happiness is one. But he says, beatitude is not the reward for virtue, but virtue itself, right? Not the reward for living a certain kind of life, but built into living a certain kind of life. Wow. Brooks continues, improvement in these areas requires commitment and effort, like anything else that's worthwhile. But if you do the work, you will most definitely see substantial results. And this reminds me of the epigraph. If you have Ricard's book, he starts out by quoting Luca and Francesco Cavalli Sforza. This is the quote. They're saying, happiness does not come automatically. It's not a gift that good fortune bestows on us or a reversal of fortune takes away. It depends on us alone. One doesn't become happy overnight, but with patient labor day after day. Happiness is constructed, and that requires effort and time. In order to become happy, we have to learn how to change ourselves. Again, isn't that what the Buddhist path is all about? Isn't that what we're doing? I'm reminded here too of this lovely verse by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Four lines, right? Sow in the sense of plant, sow a thought, reap a deed. Sow a deed, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny, right? I like to quote this because I think it really gives a lot of insight into karma, right? Whether or not karma is some kind of objective law of the cosmos like Newton's or Einstein, as it's usually understood, I think it's a deep, profound, subjective truth about how our attitude, our thoughts, our intentions toward the world literally changes the way we experience the world and how we experience ourselves, how other people respond to us, right? And it's interesting, from the very beginning, Buddhism has emphasized so much intention, our intentions, our motivations. So, you know, we're told if what we do is motivated by the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, it's going to create problems. Those are not the habits we want. But if what we do is motivated by generosity, by loving kindness and the wisdom that recognizes our interconnectedness, then the results are very likely to be positive. Again, those are the habits we want to develop, the habits especially of good intentions. And as Brooks and so many other people are saying, this is essential to becoming happy, to having the byproduct, the side effects of happiness. So that's the second maxim, according to Brooks. Number three, finally, he says, happiness is love. In the early 5th century, he says, St. Augustine summarized all of human ethics in the dictum, love and do what you will. The happiest people, he says, has lives focused on love of family, of friends, of others through work that serves, and in some cases of the spiritual as well. Research on people who wind up happy and healthy as they grow old shows that the most important part of life is to cultivate a series of stable, long-term love relationships. He goes on, not everyone enjoys a love-filled life, it's true, but here's the best news. You have a great deal of control over this because love is a decision and a commitment. Augustine defines love as, quote, to will the good of the other. You can't choose how much love you're going to get, but happiness depends much more on how much you give. And what you give your love to matters just as much. Augustine taught that to be happy, a person, quote, neither loves what he ought not to love, nor fails to love what he ought to love. And here Brooks ends with a handy formula to go by. Happy people love people and use things. Unhappy people use people and love things. I love it. I'll say it again. Happy people love people and use things, right? Unhappy people love things and use people. But what does Buddhism have to say about love? Well, a lot of things we could talk about, but in addition to the five precepts that perhaps the, you know, even more familiar to, right? The things that we're taught to avoid, right? Don't harm life, steal, lie, drugs that cloud the mind, sexual, improper sexual behavior and all that. So those are the five things not to do. But of course, the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, also emphasized things we should do. And perhaps the one that stands out the most are the four Brahma Viharas, literally Brahma, the god Brahma, right? The four divine or heavenly abodes that we are supposed to cultivate. And it's interesting, three of the four are forms of love, right? First one, metta. Most of us are familiar with that, usually translated as loving kindness. But actually, I think, I wonder if it's better a sort of basic friendliness, right? Or unconditional goodwill, if that's a better way to describe the kind of baseline attitude that with which we encourage other people, or with which we encounter other people. Karuna, compassion for the suffering of others, right? Mudita is empathetic joy or sympathetic joy in the sense that we share in the joy of others. Like if we see a little child in a park have, you know, playing and having so much fun, you know, we share, we feel his joy, his or her joy, right? And then finally, the fourth one, upeka, equanimity or even-mindedness, right? The capacity not to be disturbed by what happens to us. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as, quote, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will, right? Why are they called divine abodes? Because, as Joanna Macy says, they take you to the heart of reality. Then, for all intents and purposes, you are in heaven. You practice that loving kindness. You look at everyone with the eyes of compassion and joy and equanimity, and there's nowhere else to go. You're home. You're happy. I guess those four are as good a definition of happiness as I know. There is, however, another divine abode or aspect of love that I think might be added to these four Brahma Viharas, or maybe it's inherent within them, maybe it's already implied, but I think it's good to make it more explicit. I think it merits more recognition because, as Cicero, right, the Roman writer said, gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but it's the parent of all the others. According to the Dalai Lama, quote, the roots of all goodness lie in the appreciation of gratitude. But to be frank, it certainly took me a long time to appreciate the importance of that appreciation. I mean, yeah, we all know it's good to be grateful, right? But why emphasize something that's so obvious? But eventually I realized what wasn't obvious, which is, or at least to me, that gratitude isn't something that you feel or don't feel, but gratitude is actually a practice, a really important spiritual practice, an important practice for us, right? Here I have a quote from Omram Mikhail Ivanov. I think he must be Eastern Orthodox. The day I acquired the habit of consciously pronouncing the words, thank you, I felt I had gained possession of a magic wand capable of transforming everything. According to James Baraz, who, as many of you know, teaches Dharma courses on awakening joy, psychological studies have found that people who are depressed improve if at the end of each day they write down 10 things they're grateful for, which happened that day. You know, maybe the best summation of this attitude is by the Christian brother David Steindl Rast, who said, "We are not grateful because we are happy. We are happy because we are grateful." Oh my God. We are not grateful because we're happy. We're happy because we're grateful. Ingratitude practice, means and ends, the practice and its fruit become the same thing, right? And I think it's all the more important because, frankly, we live in a culture that does not encourage us to be grateful. In fact, the whole point of consumerism is find ways with advertising to encourage us not to be grateful, because if we're grateful, then we're going to be less likely to want the new things that we're being told that we need, right? If people are happy with what they've got, then they're going to be less concerned about getting more. But as I like to say, why is more and more always better if it's never enough? Frank A. Clark, I don't know who he is, but I like his quote. If a fellow isn't thankful for what he's got, he isn't likely to be thankful for what he's going to get. Yeah. The English word gratitude comes from the Latin gratis, meaning for thanks, in the sense of for nothing in return, right? Without like recompense. And of course, we still use the word in that sense, right? Gratis, meaning free of charge. Insofar as we are thankful, we participate in what is called like a gift economy, rather than the exchange economy where we pay for what we receive. Exchange really emphasizes our separateness, right? Transaction concluded, we go our own way. But gratitude reinforces our connectedness. Appreciation really binds us together, and again, helps us to overcome that sense of separation. I especially cherish the way that Meister Eckhart said it. If the only prayer you ever say in your life is, "Thank you," that will be enough. In his autobiography, Tales of Wonder, the religion scholar Houston Smith, a very important figure in that in religion departments, right? He describes an arduous month-long practice when he lived in Kyoto and, you know, lived in Myoshinji, a Zen monastery there. Pretty tough. When it was over and time to say goodbye, Smith went to pay his respects to the teacher, Zuigan Goto Roshi, who then surprised him by sort of knocking Zen off its pedestal. He said, "Yeah, koans, they can be useful, but they're not really Zen. Even Zazen, right, Zen meditation, that's not Zen either." So, you know, Smith was wondering, well, what the hell have I been doing? What is Zen? "You will be flying home tomorrow," Goto said. "Don't overlook how many people will help you get home. Ticketing agents, pilots, cabin attendants, those who prepare your meals." He bowed and placed his palms together, gassho, the gesture of gratitude in Japan. Then he did a gassho to me. "Make your whole life unceasing gratitude," he said. "What is Zen?" Simple, simple, so simple. Infinite gratitude toward all things past. Infinite service to all things present. Infinite responsibility to all things future. Have a safe journey home. And he gave me a wonderful smile. "I am glad you came." He was happy. He was grateful that Houston Smith had come. Let me end this section, or just, I mean, but pretty much we're at the end, but there's this lovely little poem about thankfulness, the author's unknown. just reminding us how many things that we have to be grateful for, which we're often not because we just sort of take them for granted, right? The mess to clean up after a party, because it means I've been surrounded by friends. The taxes I pay, because it means I'm employed. The clothes that fit a little too snug, because it means I have enough to eat. A lawn that needs mowing, windows that need cleaning, and gutters that need fixing, because it means I have a home. All the complaining I hear about our government, because it means we have freedom of speech. The space that I find to park at the far end of the parking lot, because it means I'm capable of walking. My huge heating bill, because it means I am warm. That's an important one these last few days, right? The lady behind me in church who sings off key, because it means I can hear. The piles of laundry and ironing, because it means I have clothes to wear. The alarm that goes off in the early morning, because it means I am alive. So, may we remember, rule number one, Mother Nature doesn't care if we're happy. That's our responsibility. We have to learn. Number two, lasting happiness comes from habits, not hacks, which is what we're one of the things we're developing in our practice, right? Three, maxim three, happiness is love. And again, really, I think one of the most powerful, one of the most important indications of love is gratitude. And often its expression, generosity, huh? It's interesting how, as I remember, Arthur Brooks in that article, I don't think he ever mentioned the word Buddhism. I think he was careful not to sort of tie it to religion. But frankly, I think that these three are also a pretty good summary of the Buddhist path. Thank you.